From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. On this week's show, we're taking you around the world. Anaheim is predominantly Latino, but last summer, the city council voted to officially name a one-mile stretch of businesses as Little Arabia. Los Angeles Times columnist Gustavo Arellano, who is also KCRW's Orange County Line contributor, is our man on the ground. He joins me to discuss the history and importance of recognizing this ethnic enclave.
Hola, Evan.
Where in Anaheim is Little Arabia? How many city blocks does it encompass?
So you would think I would know how many city blocks, given I'm born and raised in Anaheim, but I can't answer that question. But I can answer where exactly is it. So the spine of it is going to be Brookhurst Street between La Palma Avenue on the northern end, and then right onto the edge of the border of Garden Grove on Garden Grove Boulevard. And then from there, it goes, you know, it spans across Ball Road, and you see La Palma, Catella, just all around that basic neighborhood. You have some Middle Eastern restaurants and businesses on Euclid, some more towards Buena Park on Beach Boulevard, Magnolia, all of that. So it's a lot of businesses. Advocates say it's the largest collection of Middle Eastern businesses in the United States outside of the Detroit area in Michigan.
When did Arab American merchants or immigrant Arab merchants start setting up shop in this part of Orange County?
So for foodways, the pioneer businesses, there's one market called Alta Bayet Market. That's on the corner of Brookhurst Street and Ball. And that one dates back to the late 1980s. It was a family that opened it, and it's still there. I like to go there to get, of course, olive oils, garlic paste, their version of salsa, condiments more than anything. And then right across the street from it is Kareem's Restaurant, which we talked about here years ago. But that one dates back to the early 1990s. Mike and Nasreen Hawari, a husband and wife team, they opened it up. It has some of the best falafels I've ever tasted. Mike tragically passed away in the early 2000s, and now it's their son, Kareem, the namesake of the restaurant, Kareem Hawari, young guy, still in his mid-20s, he's now running the restaurant along with his mother.
That's so wonderful. How long has the community tried to pass this through the city council?
So I remember when I started as a food critic, this is now 20 years ago, they used to call it Little Gaza because there's a lot of Palestinians. I mean, you see all the Middle East there, Libyans, Palestinians, Lebanese, Syrians. So it got the name Little Gaza for some reason. Then that kind of fell by the wayside and people started calling it Little Arabia. So I remember efforts. People sort of generally talked about it in the mid-2000s. And then in 2010s, there was a couple of activists who started saying, hey, we could get more business here by getting one of those freeway signs that says Little Arabia Commercial District. Gosh, when was it? At the former newspaper edited, OC Weekly, we did a story about that effort like in 2012. And just the pushback that they were getting from a conservative-leaning city council saying, like, no, there's no reason. If we have it for one ethnic group, then why not have it for other ethnic groups? And that obviously upset a lot of people.
So this time around, who were the leaders lobbying to get official recognition from the city?
Well, one of the guys has been there almost from the beginning, Rashad Al-Dabeh. He has been advocating for this forever. And so he was one of the people that we profiled way back when. Another person, Raida Hamida, is most famous because she does an event called Taco Trucks at Every Mosque. So they get a taco truck that serves for free halal beef and chicken tacos. You have a service at the mosque, you have the tacos, and then there's another event that goes with it. You know, during when it's election season, it's voter registration. During the COVID pandemic, it was get a vaccine. But there's a lot of other people just advocating, also just business people who say, like, look, we have a great collection of businesses, especially after the pandemic. We need more business here. We need to recover from the pandemic. Please, city council, listen to what we have to say and just call it Little Arabia. It doesn't cost anything. I mean, the only cost will be freeway signs. But other than that, it's just free publicity for a city that needs to be known for more than just Disneyland and the convention center and the sports teams.
The council members ended up voting 5-0 in favor of recognizing Little Arabia, with one member abstaining from the vote. Historically, why do you think mayors have opposed the designation? Has there been pushback from the Latino community? Would that matter to the council?
That's the thing. The only people I have ever heard besides politicians opposed to this are, for lack of a better term, people who just don't get what modern-day Anaheim is. Modern-day Anaheim, it is majority Latino, but especially, again, as a native, there's so many small little communities there. I remember growing up with Laotian, not Hmongs, but Laotians, Pakistani, Romanians. There's a huge Romanian community in Anaheim. One of the few Romanian restaurants in Southern California is actually down the street from where I grew up, off of Euclid, Dunărea, a really, really great place. And so you just grow up with it and you're like, oh, cool. And sometimes, especially if you grow up with the kids, you learn how to eat Filipino food. You learn how to eat Taiwanese food. So I never heard anyone complain about Little Arabia, least of all Latinos. I mean, we always joke that Arabs and Latinos, we're brothers from another madre. We all have the uncle that looks like, you know, like a Middle Eastern star, like Omar Sharif or something like that, you know? Like my grandma, she always wore a veil in public. That's how she always grew up. So we have that affinity with that community. So ever since that designation was passed, when you tell people, they're like, oh, cool. That's awesome. I should check it out.
So it is Ramadan, and it's a time, particularly in the evening, when people break their fast, there is a lot of eating of sweets. Are there any particular bakeries in the area that you'd like to give a shout out to?
Oh, my God. My favorite is Le Mirage Pastry. They have one of my favorite cookies, for lack of a better term, of all time, mamoules. So mamoule is going to be stuffed with pistachios or a date paste or almonds as well. It's like just this crumbly, yummy thing. And of course, you have the baklava. But the interesting thing about Le Mirage, and they have cakes as well, but Le Mirage also does a special type of Syrian ice cream called bouza. And bouza, the way you do it, you basically pound it into existence, and it's stretchy, marshmallowy. They make it with mastic, and has this anise scent. It's the only place in Southern California where you could find this type of ice cream, bouza, and it is absolutely delicious. They sprinkle some pistachios from Turkey, a little bit of rose water, and they present it to you right there. It is amazing.
What other designated enclaves does Little Arabia join in Orange County?
Well, of course, you have Little Saigon, probably the most famous one. There's the Korean Business District in Garden Grove. Although now the biggest unofficial Koreatown in Orange County is in Buena Park in Fullerton. Irvine is just a United Nations of everyone. This is something that I've been trying to advocate on KCRW for so long. Orange County is so much more than just the politics. I mean, in my time reviewing restaurants, I was able to find communities of Samoans, communities of Persians. I found a Pakistani enclave right in the heart of Little Saigon. I mentioned the Romanians. We still have a Polish community, not so much anymore. We still have Italians and, of course, Mexicans and Central Americans and Colombians. We have a lot of Colombians as well. It's just a matter of going beyond whatever Yelp tells you, driving down those strip malls, just like, you know, the late great Jonathan Gold would advise all of us to do, and just look at a marquee that you've never seen before. Try to see the magic name restaurant and then go in there and see what's up. I guarantee you it's probably going to be something you've never had before.
It's always so great to talk to you, Gustavo. Thank you so much.
Gracias.
That was Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the Los Angeles Times and KCRW's Orange County Line contributor. We've been discussing Anaheim's official recognition of Little Arabia. Next up for Gustavo, he'll be joining me on April 30th at KCRW's Good Food Pie Fest and Contest as a judge for the lineage category. Won't you join us? Head to kcrw.com for more details to enter as a baker or to attend and eat pie. This is a free event, but we'd love it if you could RSVP. Coming up, we catch up with the whirlwind, who is Jose Andres.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now. at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. Jose Andres is a whirlwind in the form of a man. From a culinary standpoint, he's a prodigious talent who combines the traditional rustic tastes of Spain with 21st century imagination and finesse. When I last counted, he had 19 restaurants, or maybe it was 22. Then there are the cookbooks, the interviews, the PBS show, and all the other trappings of being a high-profile chef. But then Jose showed us his deeper self with World Central Kitchen, a nonprofit that catalyzes local chefs living in disaster areas to feed their communities, and to do it using as much local product as possible. The man embodies hospitality and caring for others. Hi, Jose.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. It's so great to have you. And I understand that you're in LA from time to time now.
Well, I've been in LA, I would say, very often for the last, 12, 13 years. I feel very at home in LA. My wife loves LA. My daughters love LA. I love LA. And LA has been great to me. So, you know, I love to find always reasons to keep being part of LA.
There was a period of time where we missed you.
Yeah.
And now, once again, there are opportunities to taste your food. Tell us where we can eat your food here in LA right now.
We had an amazing run at the SLS in Beverly Hills in La Cienega Boulevard.
That was fantastic.
Obviously, we had the different concepts, the swimming pool and the three meal of the restaurant. But then obviously we had Bazaar, which I was very proud of the work we did at Bazaar, and I think LA welcomed us with open arms. And I think Bazaar became, you know, an important part of the dining culture of this city. But then, you know, like every business, after 10 plus years, ownerships change. The different people have different objectives for the properties. And we felt like it was in the best interest of everybody, used to let everybody do what they wanted. And me, I wanted to keep pushing Bazaar to be, for me, Bazaar has been very important because it was my first big restaurant outside Washington, D.C. And I wanted Bazaar to keep being that, a place of very, very amazing moments. And so the good news is that in the process of closing Bazaar, we already knew we were going to find a home, which is here at the Conrad. We'll be opening over the course of this year. And I cannot wait for that to happen. But in between, at the Conrad Hotel, we've been very blessed that the Conrad Hotel, in this amazing property by Frank Gehry, across the street from the other Frank Gehry building, the Disney Concert Hall, that I was able to open San Laurel, which is a more Mediterranean restaurant, where you can come and have an amazing, simple Mediterranean with touches of Spain menu overlooking the Disney Concert Hall.
When do you think Bazaar will happen?
Well, everything has to do with construction, but before the end of this year, LA would see Bazaar coming back to life.
That's very exciting. So when you're here in California, how does our place here influence the way that you cook, the produce, our slightly wacky culture?
Listen, remember, I'm from Spain, okay? And this town is called Los Angeles.
Yes, it is.
And California is full of Spanish names. And as a Spaniard, with permission of the Native Americans, I feel like when I'm in California, I don't come as a foreigner. I feel at home. That's why in this place I am, where we call Agua Viva, we have a little bit of Latin flavors all over. California is an amazing connection with Asia. So it's kind of maybe the Spain, Latin touches of Asia, very comfortable. So, you know, for me, Los Angeles, in more ways than one, now that my three daughters are away from home, they feel like the place my wife and I, we are thinking that we will be very happy to change cities to move to.
Ooh.
Everybody knows I'm a Washingtonian with an accent, but this part of California, everywhere from San Francisco, the way to La Jolla, San Diego, and everything in between, I don't know, it's a place that we love. We love water. We love the citrus. We love the vegetables. We love the people. We love the mixing of cultures. I don't know. This place, to me, is a very happy place.
So give us an idea of where in the world you're working right now.
Well, I want to make sure everybody understands that I was the founder. I am the founder of World Central Kitchen. I used to be the chair of the board. Now I'm just a board member. And what I am is a volunteer. A lot of things still go through me in World Central Kitchen, in the big things, because, you know, I've been first volunteer as a founder of World Central Kitchen. And in the big ones, I realized that I have experience that I can bring to the table, sharing with members of World Central Kitchen, and keep you thinking out of the box as we do. We've done hundreds of millions of meals over the last 14 years. We are an organization that, while there are more official and bigger organizations, sometimes we are the ones that we seem to be the bigger unofficial organization. In Bahamas, we show up after Dorian. We've done volcanoes, we've done Hawaii and Guatemala, we've done tornadoes, we've done every single hurricane in the Caribbean and America. Over a year ago, in this 1 year anniversary of Ukraine, World Central Kitchen, we arrived very quickly, and within weeks, we were doing hundreds of thousands of meals a day that became 1.5 million meals a day. We did seeds for farmers that couldn't find them. I've spent almost 100 days of my life in the last year in Ukraine. For me, it's been probably one of those moments that I will never forget in my life. Risky moments. We lost two people by this crazy bombing of Russia into civil structures. We had two people sleeping in a cultural center, and a missile hit. And those were two amazing people. For me, it's hard because we don't want to put anybody in harm's way. But when you are in Ukraine, everywhere is a dangerous place. But still, people have to eat. That's why I needed to be there so much, because I cannot ask for others to do what I'm not willing to do myself. At the same time of Ukraine, we saw the news of Turkey. And we've reached over 400,000 meals between Turkey and Syria. Multiple big cities and hundreds of small towns. And I'm very happy that in probably the biggest earthquake that we are going to see in the last 100 years, World Central Kitchen was able to partner so quickly to provide early relief. At the same time, we've been in Chile in the fires. We keep showing up in big or small every day in more parts of the world. It's amazing because we have a very small team. Yes, I'm the founder, but I see myself as just one more of the thousands of volunteers that every mission joined World Central Kitchen.
Is there an opportunity for young chefs who want to work with World Central Kitchen to make a career?
I would say, obviously, the answer will always be yes. But I can say that some of the best people we have, there are no people that apply through the webpage, which you could.
It's people who show up.
Like Sandy. Sandy Ors, I mean, she's right now in Turkey. Sandy began working with us in Wilmington, in North Carolina, after the hurricane. She came as one more volunteer. Now she has become a very important team member. Fatima, we met her in Guatemala after the volcano exploded. She was one person out of the blue that came and began helping her people, helping us help them. She became part of World Central Kitchen, a very important team member. Chef Jason, he began in Ventura, in the fires in California. Now Chef Jason occupies one of the more important chef positions, if not the most important, in the organization. I can keep going on and on. So I would say World Central Kitchen is an organization that has a space for everybody. Remember that if anything ever happens in your community, World Central Kitchen will be around the corner somewhere. Find us. That's the spirit of World Central Kitchen, that we allow locals to join us, because we know that with the locals, we become better.
Even now, so many, especially smaller independent restaurants, are still struggling quite a bit. Do you see a role for the organization continuing to help?
Obviously, the situation of restaurants in America is complex, because it's not to restaurants alike, it's not to neighborhoods alike, it's not to cities alike. The realization we all had is that I think the world is better with restaurants in their communities. Restaurants are not just a name that comes from restoring your body, is restoring your soul, and is restoring your belief and faith in community, your belief that you are part of something bigger than yourself. But restaurants, remember, they are not the beginning. They are almost the end of a very big food chain where everybody matters. To have a strong country, to have a strong communities, we all need to be, and especially at the policy level, that we need to give more importance to food, because we need to make sure that everybody is not paid the minimum wage, but that everybody is able to earn a dignified living wage. We need to make sure that the farmers, that those men and women working for long hours, that able to have a dignified work with a dignified salary. In the process of feeding America, the people that feed America cannot feed themselves. This is the conundrum that we need to solve.
Thank you so much. Hear, hear.
Thank you very much for dedicating me some of your time. I know many of these interviews you've done in your life, thousands of them, and I'm so proud I'm spending time here with you.
It's always lovely. Maybe one day we'll meet on that terrace and have a cocktail together.
Agua Viva is here waiting for you. And hopefully you'll see more of me, no less.
That would be a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Adios.
Adios. That was the marvelous Jose Andres. We'll have links to his restaurants, his podcast, Longer Tables, and his other endeavors on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, we take a trip on the Trans-Siberian Railway. That's next when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. One of our favorite categories in this year's Pie Fest and Contest is Lineage Pie. It's inspired by an exhibition at UCLA's Fowler Museum titled Amir H. Falla, The Fallacy of Borders. We're encouraging bakers to use globally inspired flavors to create a pie that's deeply personal. For example, mine might be a boysenberry pie, recalling the trips I took to Knott's Berry Farm when it was still a berry farm. Or it could be a pie inspired by cabbage and dill. Really, I could go either way. Your pie might be based on your heritage or your travels. And there are few trips more mythologized than one on the Trans-Siberian Railway. Since this famed route through Siberia was completed in 1916, countless people have penned accounts of the voyage, which connects Russia's capital, Moscow, to Vladivostok, a port city more than 5,000 miles to the east. Talented New Orleans-based artist, illustrator, and author Emma Fick adds her engaging illustrated travelogue to the adventurers who came before her. The work is Border Crossings. I interviewed Emma just after the war in Ukraine started, and we didn't feel comfortable airing it because, well, Russia. But it really is a unique book, so we're sharing it now. Hi, Emma.
Hi. I'm so excited to talk to you about this.
Well, it's just such an engaging book. What is the Trans-Siberian Railway?
Well, you covered it pretty well in the intro. It is the longest railway in the world. It actually has three routes, which a lot of people don't know. There's the one that you mentioned from Moscow to Vladivostok. And then there's one, it's called the Trans-Manchurian. And then there's the Trans-Mongolian, and both of those terminate in Beijing.
So give us the stats. How many days, how many cities, how many miles was your trip?
If you'd never get off the train, it's 6 to 7 full days on the train, day and night. But we knew that we wanted to make quite a few stopovers. We ended up stopping in 7 cities, if you count the beginning and the end. And it was actually supposed to be 8, but there was a small mishap in the middle of our trip, which meant that we got behind schedule and had to knock out one of our stops.
More or less, what was the longest amount of time you were on the train without a stop?
It was 38 hours, and we could have made a lot more stops than we did. There is no singular Trans-Siberian Railway experience, and this is where you really start to see that, and that what kind of trip you have is really going to depend on how many stops you make. Some people want to take it from start to finish to really feel that seven full days on the train when you enter this time warp. And we knew that we wanted a little bit of a time warp. We didn't want to get off so often that we were only spending 12 hours on the train at a time. So our longest single stay on the train was 38 hours. And I think passing that 24-hour mark and then some really gave us some of that time warp feeling that everyone talks about when they talk about this journey.
Yeah. Could you do me a favor and read the portion from the top of page 33 for me?
Sure. We found ourselves sinking deeper and deeper into a train reverie punctuated by train stops. Time became fluid and hours ran by quickly as we were lulled into some alternate universe by the rocking train and the wide landscape gliding past us through the window. The train cabins were warm. Cozy and content, even in short sleeves, we remained transfixed by the view outside the window, leaving the books in our backpacks untouched.
So you talk about how even before leaving on the trip, you experienced profound longing and even nostalgia for it, even though you had never been. What do you think there is about this particular railway and the route that causes this type of feeling in folks?
I think with any mythologized journey, there is a way in which I, as someone who had never been on the trip, felt like I'd been on it many times just by reading other people's accounts and looking at pictures. And so as you're anticipating the trip, you're also feeling as though you're remembering the trip. It's a very strange duality of feeling.
Tell us the story of your husband, who was then your boyfriend, Helvio, finding a particular book in a thrift shop that kind of jump-started this journey for the two of you.
I love this story. We were in Helsinki, Finland, and I'm an avid thrift store shopper. And I was in a thrift store spending too long looking at scarves and dishes that I obviously couldn't take with me. And he's a very patient man, and he just stood by the books and was looking through them. And when I went to the register to pay, he came up and said, "Hey, can you get this too?" And I was surprised because he has never asked to get anything when I'm on one of my thrift rampages. And I looked at it, and it was the Trans-Siberian Handbook that we ended up taking with us on the trip. And I looked at it, and I looked at him, and he said, "This has been my dream since I was a boy in Brazil."
So let's talk a bit just about the railway. Who created it and why was it created?
The short answer is that Siberia before the Trans-Siberian Railway was really not accessible. I mean, it still has the reputation of being this desolate landscape where you send prisoners to suffer and work and maybe die in obscurity. And it had that reputation for a reason. The railway made it possible to populate this vast portion of Russia that previously had not been able to have any population or any functioning cities. It allowed Russia to move huge quantities of its resources from one end to another and then to get them to other parts of the world. So it was both a military and economic stronghold for Russia and was incredibly important in establishing its dominance in the world stage.
And today, is it just a fantasy ride, or does the railway still fulfill a practical purpose?
Not at all. I would say that it is really only a fantasy ride for foreigners. It still transports a huge amount of industrial product, and people take it just as you would take a bus or an airplane.
What did you pack to bring? I'm so curious about what turned out to be the greatest comfort in the stuff that you brought along.
Mm-hmm. We had done quite a bit of research on the food to bring because it's pretty daunting to be stuck for a day, 2 days, and have to eat out of your backpack. And the main thing is that you have access to a hot water heater. And when I say hot water, I mean it comes out boiling. But the value of that burning hot water is that you can make instant noodles. And I would say that was the biggest comfort because after 12, 14, 20 hours, you get a little bit sick of the cold food, and making those noodles turned out to be a lifesaver.
Now, we should say that you were traveling in second class and you're frugal. So many people may have had a million meals in the dining car, but you chose not to. Talk about a few of your dining car experiences and how different they were from dining car to dining car as that car actually changed throughout the voyage.
Yes, the dining cars were one of my favorite parts of the train journey. And I will say, I'm frugal, but not so frugal that I will deny myself an experience. So our decision was that every train we were on, we would eat in the dining car once. The dining cars are changed according to the country. So when you cross the border from Mongolia to China, for example, they take off the Mongolia dining car and put on the Chinese dining car. And for that reason, it's always at the end of the train. But it also depends on which train you're on. There are all these different numbers of the train. Not every dining car across every line is the same. So I ate at one Chinese dining car, one Russian one, and one Mongolian one, but there are so many others that I didn't get a chance to try. The decor in each is fantastic and one of my favorite parts. The Russian dining car looked like some futuristic space shuttle scene. It had these vinyl seats in this like deep maroon reddish color, these wild swirls on the curtains. The Chinese dining car that we were in looked like kind of like a classic diner. It looked more like something you would walk into not on a train. And then the Mongolian dining car had the brightest, bright pink and yellow clashing tablecloths and curtains that I've ever seen. So it's like walking into a little universe when you walk back and enter that dining car. And we tried to order in each car something that was classic or traditional to the country that the dining car belonged to. So we got borscht in the Russian dining car. And I will say the Russian one was our least favorite, even though I love Russian food. We got a fermented bean chicken dish in the Chinese dining car, and the Chinese dining car was our favorite. It was morning when we ate in the Mongolian dining car, so I feel like I didn't give it a fair shot because we just got an omelet, and who can tell anything from an omelet?
So you finally cross the border into Russia, and you leave the train again in Irkutsk. Tell us about the market there.
Oh, I loved that market. There were all of these stalls, and like a lot of markets, it's divided by sections. There's the meat section, the fish section, the caviar section, the biscuit section. But this market had one of the best biscuit sections I've ever seen in my life. And I'm kind of a biscuit connoisseur, I would say, because every country almost has its version of like the snack biscuit you take in your bag with you. I almost always stop and get whatever that country has to offer. So when I went to this market in Irkutsk and saw that they had these stalls that were stuffed to the brim. They were almost like glass boxes, and they were just piled floor to ceiling, pushed up against the glass with hundreds of different types of kind of tea biscuits. My head started spinning around. I just lost my mind.
I have to ask you, you took this trip in 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And with the war in Ukraine happening and the reverberations surrounding Russia, you must have some thoughts on having been able to take this trip and the increased difficulty to do it now.
I do. And I will also say, just first of all, I have lived and traveled in a lot of places that have extremely vicious and problematic and awful governments. And actually, as a citizen of the U.S., I consider myself to live in one of those places. And also, as someone who lives in the South, I identify with that. And so I have always kept a firm differentiation between the people of a place and their government. I mean, I know all too well how it feels to have a government that you feel does not represent you. So I still feel so much tenderness towards the Russian people and towards the cultures that I got to experience with them. So I just wanted to start by saying that. And then you're absolutely right. When I started on this book, which was in 2019, I imagined that it would be something that people could read and then take in their hands with them on the trip. And now it looks like it'll be more of a time capsule because I am not sure when the Russian border will be open for, especially for Americans. It might be a decade. So Originally, I thought that this would be a book you could take with you on the trip. And now I think this book might be the only way to take the trip itself.
Thank you so much, Emma. It's really just a fabulous book.
Thank you so much. And I really enjoyed talking about it with you.
That was artist Emma Fick. You can find her fantastically illustrated travelogue in her book, Border Crossings, A Journey on the Trans-Siberian Railway. To see a few pictures from her journey, visit our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. When we caught up with Raghavan Iyer at the end of 2022, it was to chat about curry in all its complexity and contradiction. Born in Mumbai, Raghavan moved at age 21 to Minnesota, where he fell in love and found his passion. Missing the food he'd eaten while growing up, he wrote letters to his family back home. They shared recipes and techniques that he in turn shared with Americans. This led to a brilliant career as the author of 6 critically acclaimed cookbooks and a James Beard Award. Last week, we heard the sad news that Raghavan had passed at age 61 of cancer. With his erudition and gentle wit, he was one of our favorite guests. I feel lucky I had a chance to speak with him about his final book on the curry trail. So in honor of Raghavan Iyer and his legacy, we're sharing it with you once again. Hi, Raghavan.
Hi, Evan. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, we're so happy to have you here. Do we know how far back curry dates in India?
In India, it dates back to about 3,000 to 4,000 years before Christ. And, you know, you think back to one of the earliest civilizations known to mankind, Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa, which is, you know, where India and part of Pakistan is located at now. And, you know, we were roasting and grinding spices since then. And they all became the basis for many of our stews. And because, you know, in curries in India, it has everything to do with the sauce. The book that I had authored a few years ago, 660 Curries, delved into the world of curries as witnessed in the Indian subcontinent, which included India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Nepal, and Bhutan.
And in this book, you do something a little different. You kind of take us on a trip of spice and sauce.
Yes, and this is, I've always said this is looking at the diaspora of curries and curry powders as seen through the eyes of the colonials. Because it really, you know, I give credit to the British for coining the concept of curry powders. And that's what they spread to the rest of the world.
So often now when we think of curry of any kind, we think of red chili, we think of red pepper. But in fact, it was black pepper, the peppercorn, that catapulted curry around the globe.
Yes, and that's what the whole world came to India was for, the black peppercorns. In fact, it was a long form of black pepper, piper nigrum, that they came to India for. And then, of course, you know, they fell in love with black peppercorns, which also became a source of trading, especially, you know, in England. People were paying rent with black peppercorns. And so the pungency and the complexity of curries, even to this day in southern India, actually comes with the prevalent usage of black peppercorns.
It must have been fascinating for you to do all this research and dip in so strongly to this idea of curry powder when it's so antithetical.
Yes.
To cooking on the subcontinent.
Yes. And it was a mind shift for me, you know, and especially when the first book was so adamant about what curries are to Indians, it flew in the face of earth of what I thought of curries. And so to, you know, get into the world of curry powders, research was definitely the way to go. And I'd hired an incredible friend who used to work for NPR and an archivist, and she did a brilliant job in providing me information and materials on curries. And I always said, you know, I gave her some specifics of how I wanted it, and she gave me a 400-page PDF with a 10-page glossary, which, you know, and for me to take all of that and then condense it in the form of head notes and stories was a challenge. But, you know, I guess something good came off COVID, and it sort of forced me to work on it. And I wrote the book during a dark time in my life. And as you know, I've been living with cancer now for 4.5 years, metastatic cancer. And so the book I wrote, it was a diversion that I really needed. And, you know, I looked at how, you know, all the European countries came to India, you know, the Portuguese, the Spanish, the Danish, and then, of course, the English, and how they all left their mark in terms of what they wanted to leave in India. But more important, I mean, they got a lot out of India, you know, all the expensive jewelry and the gems and, of course, spices, which was a moneymaker for them. And even though India was in the spice trade years before that, along with the Buddhist monks, you know, that's why you look at the influence of Buddhism and the Far Eastern countries, and how their food was a reflection of the utilization of spices. And you look at Thai curries, for instance, and how, you know, they defined their curries based on the kind of paste that they fashioned from a combination of dry and wet ingredients. So they came up with the concept of red, yellow, and green curry paste.
You say in the book that Thailand is the country outside of India most devoted to curry.
Yes. You know, I mean, that's where you also saw the influence of Buddhism and Hinduism, you know, to a big extent, and how they embraced the world of spices, and they incorporated their own fresh herbs like lemongrass and lime leaves and galangal root, and that all became bases of their curry paste.
The word authentic, especially when it comes to food, can be so loaded. And
yes.
Then there are the terms classic and traditional. Why do you shy away from all of these labels?
I hate them because, you know, they when you're talking about a tradition, I always say, what tradition? You know, especially when India is an amalgamation of so many different cultures. Authentic, you know, what is that? I remember having a conversation with an Indian when I was in one of my book tours years ago. And he said, you know, what you're doing is not authentic Indian food. I said, can you define to me what is authentic Indian food? He goes, well, you know, my mother's cooking. And I said, well, I'm not your mother. And I said, you know, this is cooking that is versatile. So I prefer using the phrase dynamic.
I'd love to just talk about a few of the powders. You know, when I was growing up, the one curry powder that my mother had was Madras,
yes.
Madras curry powder.
Uh-huh.
You say it's embarrassingly simple.
It is. And it's really a handful of, you know, grocery store spices. I mean, you're talking coriander, cumin, cinnamon, cardamom, peppercorns, chilies, you know, and nutmeg and ground ginger. And so by its nature, I think, you know, the availability of those ingredients, and all you really have to do is grind them, and you've got, you know, an aromatic blend that knocks your socks off. And I feel like, you know, it, like I've said in the book, I mean, if you don't have 5 minutes to spare, you know, you're missing out on something that is so exceptional. And it takes less, you know, 5 minutes to you measure out your ingredients, you put them in a spice grinder, and you've got an amazing blend that can last you for months and create dishes that really sing with flavor.
That was Raghavan Iyer, who passed away at the end of March, discussing his final book, On the Curry Trail, Chasing the Flavor That Seduced the World. It came out in March. Next up, belly up to a bowl of the popular porridge, Haleem. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. For years, I've enjoyed the Iranian porridge, Haleem, made with soft wheat and turkey that are cooked into mush and topped with ghee, sugar, and cinnamon. But there are different Haleems all over the world. We're in the midst of Ramadan, the perfect time to talk about this dish, which is eaten in various forms throughout the Muslim world. In Hyderabad, the eighth largest city in India, it is beloved, especially during this holy month, when it becomes a staple of the nightly iftar meal. Writer Anusha Kulal is here to talk about the culinary significance of Haleem, which she wrote about for Eater. Hi, Anusha.
Hello. Hi.
Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So tell us about Haleem, what it is, what the ingredients are that you have concentrated on in this article, how it's made, what it's served with. Give us an overall view.
So for almost 20 years, I actually wasn't aware what Haleem was. And I think there was a friend of mine, there was a brief mention of this dish from her. And it sounded like, you know, a mix of great ingredients like wheat, and predominantly Hyderabad Haleem uses goat meat or lamb and a bunch of other spices. And it sounded like a good mix of ingredients. And when I did a Google search, the results weren't exactly a feast to my eyes. It was meat porridge. So I didn't have much expectations. Well, if you fast forward to 2015, June, there was an upcoming trip to Hyderabad, and my friend insisted that I try this dish because this was also around the time around Ramadan. And I remember I was outside Pista House, and I obviously chose this restaurant because of how popular it is. And there was this man wearing a bright green shirt and handed me this bowl of Haleem. And my first bite into it, I just realized what I was missing out on. It was just a simple bowl of Haleem, because back then, while it was gaining popularity, it was still, you know, it wasn't the craze that it is now. It was simple Haleem topped with some caramelized onions, coriander, and also there's something called shorba, which is like a meat consomme and a slice of lemon. And this was the first time I had it, and I regretted not having it before, and I've always try to plan my trips around Ramadan so I can actually try different bowls of Haleem. Now the craze has spread across Hyderabad, and people actually travel to Hyderabad during the festival just to try different bowls of Haleem. And each year, most restaurants try to, you know, make new variations or, you know, cater to different palates and stuff like that. You can never have enough Haleem that you can try. There'll always be a new one.
Could you tell us about the restaurant that prepares approximately 2 tons of the dish every day during Ramadan?
Yeah, it's called Pista House. And they started in 1997. And, you know, originally they were just a regular standard restaurant famous for their biryanis and kebabs. And over time, the owners of the restaurant decided to bring Haleem. When they started making Haleem, they gained some traction, but they tried to petition for something called a GI status, which is the geographical indication status, which meant that it had to have meat-to-wheat ratio of a certain amount, and it need to have like cooked with pure ghee and a great quality goat meat, and had to be cooked over firewood. There were certain rules that it had to follow, and this played a great role in maintaining that quality of the dish. And one of the great things I would highly recommend anyone to do is actually see how they make 2 tons of this dish, which is not a small amount. And they have this temporary setup. It's like a giant cauldron, and it's fitted on top of mud or brick ovens. Everything is cooked in that one pot. It takes about 10 hours almost to do this. They're like a well-oiled machine. Someone's churning the dal, the lentils. Someone's, you know, chopping the meat, cleaning the chilies and stuff like that. And it all comes together. The most intense part of this process is the pounding of all of these ingredients into the porridge. This is what takes the longest time. And some of these people who are doing this are also fasting. So it's really commendable how the whole process comes together.
Yeah, the pounding and the mashing of the meat and the wheat together kind of forms the basis of what the mouth feel of eating halim is like. And I would imagine that one of the reasons it's so popular as an iftar meal is that it's so nourishing and comforting.
Yeah, it's quite heavy. I know people who can just have halim, and some have said that they can just have it as one meal and they can last the whole day. The meat to wheat ratio is 10 to 4, 10 being the meat and 4 being the wheat. I think these two ingredients, and also lentils, these are quite heavy on carbs. That's why if you're fasting all day, one bowl of halim is just enough.
Do we know the history and origins of halim?
Yeah. So there's a little city called Barkas in Hyderabad, and there's a reason why it's called Barkas, because years ago when the Nizams were ruling Hyderabad, there were a lot of Arab mercenaries who came to India and were serving the Nizams, and this little area had barracks, which was housing all the soldiers and their families. And one of the popular meals that came with the Arab mercenaries is something called haris. It is quite similar to the Iranian halim you mentioned. This meal was great for the soldiers and they would have it for breakfast. And over time, this dish was taken and people augmented it to make it more liked by the locals. And that meant adding the masalas and the ghee and the lentils and stuff like that. And it all came together. And this is how halim was born.
What is your current favorite toppings that you're seeing on halim?
Personally, I like my halim just straightforward. I do love the fried onion toppings. That's my favorite. And one of the reasons I go to the streets is not take away this stuff is because I can help myself to several servings of fried onions and, you know, a little bit of coriander and mint and lemon. But I've been seeing a trend of people also prefer the topping of chicken 65. I'm not sure if you're familiar, but it's basically chicken coated with spices and shallow fried with some curry leaves and some mustard seeds.
I love that. So it's a meat porridge garnished with more meat.
More meat, yeah, exactly.
But it can be made with a variety of other meats or ingredients, not just goat, or it can be made with no meat at all. What are some of the variations that you've seen?
You're right, yeah. Hyderabad is predominantly Muslims, and one of their main part of the diet is beef as well. So a lot of local eateries do serve beef. And of course, there are Hindus who do not actually eat beef. Across India, the most popular meat that we consume is chicken. And so they had to make a halim with chicken. But most people lean towards the lamb halim, halim made with goat meat. It's just, I think the flavor, the gamey flavor has just adds a different seasoning to the dish. And there's also, like you said, vegetarian halim. I don't know. I'm very skeptical about that one. And yes, it's great that vegetarians can have it. But I think the flavor of this dish comes from the meat itself, slow cooking the meat.
Given that the traditional way of making the dish is cooking it over firewood, is halim something that people ever make at home, or is it something they mostly eat at restaurants and food stalls?
I think these days they do prefer going to the restaurants and stalls because even making it at home is a time-consuming process. while I was even researching for this article, I met few chefs who prefer to cook it at home. They do it in a pressure cooker as opposed to a firewood. You can, you know, control how much spice you use, how much ghee you use. And if you don't want to wait for Ramadan, so you can go to the stores, because these stores mostly pop up during the festival. So if you want Haleem all year round, there are a few places that serve this, but people also, I think, would like to experiment at home.
You talked a bit about how in 2010, Haleem became the first non-vegetarian dish to earn India's geographical indication status. That must have been quite significant.
Yes, it is. So there are a few things that, you know, really, when you say a name of the place, there's always something people associate with that place. So we have Banaras silks, and we have something called Tirupati Laddu. Tirupati is a popular destination for temples, and every time someone goes there, it's the laddu they look forward to as well. So Haleem, for a non-vegetarian dish to come into this play, was something really, yeah, something that brought pride to Hyderabad. It also took off since then, actually. Since 2010, that's when the popularity started to increase. It was quite an achievement.
This has been such a lovely conversation, Anusha. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure.
That was writer Anusha Kulal explaining the significance of the savory porridge Haleem and its connection to Ramadan. We'll have a link to her story about it, which she wrote for Eater, on our website. Head to kcrw.com/goodfood. If you missed any of today's show, listen at kcrw.com/goodfood or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, Elena Shatkin, Desmond Taylor, Nick Lamponi, PJ Shahamat, and Hope Brush. And special thanks to Chrissy Van Meter, Laura Kondarajan, and Gary Masiha. With spring in the air, I'm looking forward to making a spring vegetable lasagna. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with an all-new episode of Good Food.